We're on Daf Ches Amud Beis. In the middle of the wide lines, at the end of the line. Sorry. About a third down the wide lines. Toward the end of the lines, you got Tanya. You have two dots there with the Tanya. Okay? Last word on the line is Omar. Alright? Okay? I'll just say, before we move on, just one word about the previous sugya. We ended off with the halacha that you are not allowed to pass behind a shul while there's a tefillah going on. Now, practically speaking, it's not relevant to us because it only applies if it's the only shul in town, the only minyan in town. You're not usually going to be in such a situation. If you are, you should keep it in mind. But you're not usually going to be in such a situation. But just the one point that I wanted to make was that the Gemara here again is bringing across the concept that it's incumbent upon you to avoid suspicion. It's not just, there's a din of dan lekatzkus, we're supposed to give people the benefit of the doubt. But here we're seeing also that it's actually an obligation to avoid suspicion. This is important to realize because there's of any wrongdoing. Meaning here we're saying, don't give the impression that you're not interested in davening with a minion.
We just had the Gemara that says that person in a shul with a Torah lady can turn around and do something.
We discussed
else.
That. I don't want to get back into that. That's only, we basically came out that that's not relevant in most situations. Only very distinct situations, and even then, only when he's clearly engaged in learning, such that people see that that's what he's doing. But generally, you must avoid suspicion. That's what I'm getting to. So I just want to explain this value, because it's a principle thing. It's not just a technicality of not being machshel people and suspecting you of wrongdoing. The idea is that we are supposed to be living not only with Yirat Shamayim, but we're supposed to be living in an atmosphere of Yirat Shamayim. Which means also that we're supposed to be facilitating an atmosphere of Yirat Shamayim. It's our jobs as members of a community to ensure, or to do our best to ensure, that our community has an atmosphere of Yirat Shamayim, of meticulousness about mitzvahs. And therefore, the bigger problem that someone might suspect you and look at you negatively is that a person might look at you and say, oh, alright, it's mishkeperla. The point is, we want there to be an atmosphere of there are things you do and there are things you don't do. You can be contributing to the breakdown of the standards of your community by giving the impression of wrongdoing, even if it's not necessarily so. So it goes in both directions. Yes, they have a chiyuv to give you the benefit of the doubt, but you have the chiyuv to maintain a semblance of Yirat Shamayim. Not just that the truth is I was doing the right thing. We want it to be a semblance of meticulousness, an atmosphere of meticulousness in the community. And we can't have it run the risk that people might think that not everybody is so makbid, which will inevitably influence. Okay. Now we move on. The two dots, Tanya. What's that? Yes, it is your responsibility to suspect that people will not give you the benefit of the doubt. That's right. What? In practice, meaning practically speaking. Oh, you should assume that they will give you all the benefit of the doubt, but yet in practice, don't ride on it. Also, when you're telling other people at Kafskos, you don't ride on it in practice if you have reason to wonder what the case actually is. The Mecha Shmi Abai, you have to be concerned. Okay. Now we move on. Tanya. Third down the wide lines, toward the end of the lines. Tanya. Omar Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva said, a new point, kind of related to something we discussed earlier. Beshloisha dvarim oyev aniz hamodim. I like the modim for three things. Interesting thing to say. He likes the modim, people of Modai. Let's see. Meaning there are three things I admire about them. Keshechoitchim et habosa, ein choitchim ela al gabe ha-shulchan. When they cut meat, they cut it only on the table. Now this is really basically the same idea that we discussed earlier. Don't cut meat in your hand. Kishenoishkim, when they kiss people in greeting, ein noishkim ela al gav hayad. They kiss only on the back of the head. The back of the hand. Yeah. Ukisheyoyatsin, and when they take counsel, meaning when they discuss secret matters, ein yoyatsim elo besoda. They do their counseling only in the field, meaning in an open expanse of area where there's no room for people to hide and listen in on what's going on. They see the area is clear. There's nowhere to hide. Omar Rav Adibarava. Rav Adibarava says, "My Kara." Where do we see this concept in the Torah? Famous concept. By Yishlach Yaakov, when Yaakov was planning on absconding and leaving Lavan, so he called by Yikro LiRachel Ulea Sodel Tzoynoi. When he wanted to discuss the matter with his wives, so he called them out to the field to his sheep. Didn't discuss it with them at home in the tent, because who knows who's standing right behind the door. And therefore he discussed it out in the field where it's open. You can see that nobody's hiding. I'll just note that first of all, what's a little bit strange about this Gemara is that Rabbi Akiva presumably is coming to admire virtues, not just technically good ideas. Doesn't seem that any of the things here, where's the virtue in any of these three things? The truth is there are midrashim on the first point with other girsois, with other versions of what he actually said about cutting meat. So according to our version, it's basically what we saw earlier, that cutting meat, when you cut meat in your hand, you're running the risk of messing up the meat. Now, either cutting yourself, but even if you don't cut yourself, you might cause it to get bloody. And the truth is, there is an issue of sensitivity towards others in this. You might get a little cut on your hand, but that might be enough to disgust the other people in the party who are supposed to be eating of that meat. Even if it's not a problem of this, or it's cold, you can wash it off. But there are two other versions in other midrashim of this idea. One is, when they eat meat, they don't bite out of it, rather they cut it. This is an issue of Derech Eretz, of finesse. They wouldn't pick up their food and bite it. They would cut it and eat it. It's a certain discipline. So that's something Rabbi Akiva was admiring. It shows a certain control, a certain finesse. Another girsa is, and this is also interesting, that ein choitchim al gabe ka'ora el al gabe ha-shulchan. They don't cut it on the platter yet before they bring it in. They bring it in, set it on the table, and then they cut it. Now, this is also interesting, because this is mamish, a fine aspect of hosting. It's more gishmak when you see it brought in as a whole piece. I know that my wife is very into that. I never understood. She likes to keep cakes whole before she serves them at the Shabbos table. I never understood. You're going to cut them up anyways and eat them. She said it's nicer to serve that way. Now I see that she's right. It's actually a chazal. Chazal is saying that the people will enjoy it more when it's served whole, then you cut each one a slice. Considered actually, it's an aspect of Benodom Lachaveiroi. You're enhancing their enjoyment. Very interesting. At least I found it that way. We'll see. I'm going to put that off and we're going to get to that. Bezos Hashem. Okay. What's with the kissing of the hand? Oh, that's the next point. When they kiss, they only kiss on the hand. So, two approaches on this. Rashi says that the issue here is also sensitivity to other people who might be finicky. Don't go slobbering over somebody's face if you don't know if he's going to appreciate it. That's how Rashi explains it. Some people will find it disgusting, etc. You might also add hygiene. That's it. What, to kiss hands? Instead of the face. Oh, interesting. So that's how Rashi explains it. Other Mepharshim explain it out tznius. Because of tznius. It's a bit more decent and a bit more controlled. Yeah, more refined than kissing on the face. The common etiquette of when men greet men, they shake hands, and when men greet women, strange women, it's a peck on the cheek. It's famish an animalistic display. What logic is there other than base desire to run it that way? This way, any greeting was a kiss on the hand. What's that? France don't have a very good reputation in general. So, as far as this goes, it's l'shitasam. No, but the truth is, again, we won't say in an absolute way that it's necessarily wrong. But, who's admiring this finesse? In earlier times, men and women, even in foreign cultures, weren't making contact in public. Today, things changed. Because of? I don't think people were worried about that. If you have a person that you think has an Indian stabbing you in the back, don't kiss his hand either. Okay. Tanya, Amar Rabbi Gamliel, and soon we're going to get to Jonathan's question. Right. I would guess that the reason it's presented about meat is because that was basically, as we discussed the other times, there were a few suggestions made here, but afterwards it occurred to me that it was one of the only things they cut with the meat with a knife. They didn't use. They ate with their hands. In earlier times, that was not considered. In fact, it's discussion among the Rishonim when forks first made their inroads, but it is an issue of b'chukasei loisei leichu in using forks. What's that? I don't know exactly. It's a discussion from a while back. Today, it seems to be halachically acceptable. But what's that even required? Right. That would be, according to the inyan of this Gemara, yeah. But bread was broken with the hand. What? Yishbarach, right. Breaking bread. That's the expression. What? Never. Could be, but I haven't gotten there yet. I don't know. It's not in Gemara and not in standard halakh. Could be that there are other sources. But still not in standard halakh. Oh, there might be in Yanim, but it's okay. Now, okay, so Tanya, Amar Rabbi Gamliel, Bishloisha Dvorim Oyev Ani Etzaparsim. There are three things that I like about the Persians. Tznuim ba'achilosam. They are tsanua. They eat modestly. We'll get back. First we'll see all three and then we'll come back to it. Utznuim b'beis hakise. They're modest in the bathroom. They do it b'tznius. You have to remember, today the minig is that people go to the bathroom alone and lock the door. But that wasn't always so, right? There were public outhouses, and there were different degrees of tznius you could observe in the bedroom. Utznuim b'davar achim. And there are also tzniistic in other areas, i.e. marital relations. So, let's just know what the significance of these three things is. First of all, tznuim b'achilasam. Tznuim b'achilasam means, or actually if we'll work backwards, tznuim b'davar achim. They were tzniistic, they acted with tznius about marital relations. Okay, that's obviously virtuous. Now if we back up, tzniistic about Beis HaKiseh, what's tzniistic about food? The answer is that when it comes to food also, there's an issue of tzniis. Because the more refined the person is, the more any bodily issues are something that he's not proud of, and he's not interested in flaunting. And therefore the truth is, we know what the Gemara says, the Gemara Sanhedrin says, a person who eats in public is pasul eivus. But it's a person who eats in public is disqualified as a witness. Now, this doesn't mean chewing gum in the street. Practically speaking, it means sitting down for a proper suda. The Arabs that you see on the building sites, sitting down with their pitas in plain view, they don't accept them for eivus. But the concept of sitting down in the middle of a busy plaza for a whole meal has to do with desensitization. People with refined sensitivities wouldn't feel comfortable doing something like that. Or even eating in a restaurant. Again, I'm talking about in our generation, this is where we are today. I'm not coming to undo this. But I'm saying there are people with sensitivities, or in earlier times it was certainly so, and eating was not a public activity. Eating was something that you did in private. Now, there was always such a thing as mishtois and parties, etc., but not in a public way. Now, the truth is, what's that? No, meaning not out in the street for everybody to see in a public display. And even then, there were always people of more refined sensitivities who did not like to eat in public at all. And b'chlal, it's something just to be aware that when you're involved in a base activity, when you're involved in a bodily activity, the more in touch you are with your spiritual self, the more funny you feel about displaying your bodily aspects. The truth is that's the whole concept of clothing. The whole concept of clothing is that we're ashamed that we look like animals. And therefore, by covering up most of our body and showing only our faces, it's the faces, the tzelem elokim, it's a respectable part of a person. The rest of the body, not. It's not just sneeze. We don't wear clothing just because it's sneeze. A loincloth would do for that. But the fact that we have a whole coarse physical body is something that, to an extent, is an embarrassment to us. Now, not everybody realizes that that's why they're wearing clothing. And many people actually use the clothing to accentuate their body. But on a deeper level, that's why we consider clothing a value.
That's almost, level.
Before the chet, that's the key words. We're after the chet. I don't want to get into the whole discussion about Adam now, but it's a long subject, but that's exactly the point. After the chet, it became more physical, and it was then that he covered his body. That's exactly the point. That's the source of the concept. That after the chet, it wasn't enough for him to cover himself with a loincloth, he had to actually have a full set of clothing. So, the same thing goes for eating. Rabbi Avigdor Miller used to say, people go to a restaurant where there is soft music playing, and they sit down in a beautiful atmosphere, and they eat. Said, would you go to do other bodily functions with soft music playing in dim light in front of everybody? Okay, so again, the point here is not for us to go and completely change. Why just for us to become aware of what Chazal called certain levels of finesse? And the truth is that even today, I mean, I know people, my father-in-law, I consider him my Rebbe to an extent. He has a very hard time eating in public. And I remember we were once somewhere for Shabbos where the Suda was a buffet. It was served as a buffet. He couldn't handle it. He couldn't handle coming and standing with everybody and reaching for food. food. You don't go and make a rush for food and walk around looking for what you like. Sit at the table, you serve food, you eat it without making too much of a big deal, and you move on. But right, right. So the truth is, that's why I'm trying to toe a fine line here by not obliterating the concept completely. When people are trying to get close, eating together is a very good thing to do. When people should be close, when you're trying to create a sense of camaraderie. But it's done within a certain defined circle. It's done within the family. Even when there's a chasana, the chasana is a gathering of people who are all joining together for a certain purpose and want to be celebrating together. Yes. Yes. There is something of a comparison, meaning the idea of getting together in a public place, meaning where there's just a whole bunch of haphazard people getting together just for the purpose of eating, an eatery. The concept of an eatery, he would say, is something of an animalistic concept, where it begins and ends with eating, and that's what people gather for. That's the idea. What's that? Oh no. But again, these are things that it's not the first area that we need to be working on. The sensitivities that it's worth being aware of. I eat in restaurants. My wife doesn't like it. My wife doesn't like it. But I enjoy a restaurant. I'm being very, very frank. But there's a sensitivity where there are certain things I'm not interested in displaying in a public way. Yes, but it's being done in a broad way. No, you know what? The truth is, I don't need to be convincing you that there's something wrong with it. I don't need to be convincing you that there's something wrong with it. And there's no need to be convinced that there's something wrong with it. The point is to realize that there's something base about eating that should have some impact on the way you eat. Now, for us, it's good enough if we realize that it's embarrassing to be completely obsessed with our eating, especially when we're in other people's companies, just busy digging in and packing it in as fast as we can so we can move on to the next piece. That's good enough. The point here is just to develop a certain sensitivity to bodily functions. Now, actually, we'll put this into good perspective with the next point, which is connected to the question you asked earlier. Oh, that's right. That's right. These are all good examples of that. Right. And the truth is, again, it's Sishka Felich. We're not on the level of sensitivities that Chazal were on, right? Like I said, I found it surprising the other day when I learned in Rishonim what a terrible sacrilege it is to lay the Sefer Torah without preparing. I learned that and I said to myself, that's meant to be a natural sensitivity. How can you approach a Sefer Torah without preparing? My sensitivities are not lined up. I'm glad I saw that. It's okay. It's not like we have to give it to ourselves over the head. Obviously, we're out of touch. Point here is no. It's fine. We don't have to now work backwards to try to get back into the mentality of 1,000 years ago in this sense. But to develop a certain sensitivity towards the concept. And now, we'll move on to the next part of this discussion that will put this into perspective. Jonathan asked earlier, what are these Tanaim doing here? Coming and trying to earn the Persians and the Madai people the respect of the Jewish people? Coming to praise pagans? So let's see, the Gemara put this into perspective, and then we'll have a perspective on this discussion too. After we pointed out these virtuous aspects of these nations, how do we finish it off? Anit sivisi limkudashai. The simple understanding of this pasuk, I have commanded my designated ones. This is Yeshaya prophesying about Koresh, the king of Persia, who will ultimately give the command to build the Beis HaMikdash. But we have a different take on it. Tanya Rav Yosef. Rav Yosef says, I commanded my designated ones. In what sense are they designated? Elu ha-Parsi. This refers to the Persians. Hamikudoshim umizumanim legehenim. Who are designated for Gehenim. So that's how we conclude the sugya. We named a few of their virtues, and we say, and these people are designated for Gehenim. The point being exactly this point. The Goyin says this, and others say that the point here is not to engender admiration for these people. They're despicable people, and we don't have admiration for any culture that isn't the Torah culture. But we're noting specific practices that we might do well to adopt. Now, Reb Tzaddik takes us a step further, and then we get on to back to our discussion. Reb Tzaddik notes something very paradoxical. He says, who is it that's being praised for being tzniyistic about eating and tzniyistic about marital relations? The Persians! What do we know about the Persians? We have one sefer that deals with the Persians extensively. Megillas Esther. What do we see there about their standards when it comes to tznius and eating, and when it comes to tznius and marital relations? Get a little bit of a different impression there, don't we? And the answer is yes and no. What does it say about Achashverosh? Achashverosh was busy packing them in one after the next, right? It says that people were busy hiding their daughters because he was on a rampage. And yet, we derive a halacha of hilchot tznius from his behavior. It says, he didn't cohabitate during the day, only at night. Interesting, we note that, and for us that's halacha. It's decent behavior. How does this all come together? What's going on here? In fact, if we don't have the 180-day party that they made, it says, Chazal tell us, the Persians are migudolim seir kedoy. They're big like bears, they're hairy like bears, and they eat and they drink like bears. That's what Chazal say about the Persians. Big, fat pressers. That's what Chazal say about the Persians. So, what's going on here? The Tzaddik says something amazing. He says, on the contrary, the Persians were so obsessed with eating and marital relations. I don't know about going to the bathroom. I don't know how that fits in here. But they were so obsessed with eating and with marital relations, more than other goyim. Other goyim did it to an extent that they were able to just enjoy themselves and not feel too funny about it. These people were so obsessed to the extent that at the end of the day, whatever human dignity they had left was slapping them in the face. Whatever human dignity they had left was slapping them in the face. Right? It was like a little too much. And then, therefore, they had to improvise some sense of value in this whole business. And therefore, Achashverosh, who was a complete maniac in this area, was a very principled person. Me, only at night. You'll never catch me during the day. He was principled. And therefore, yes, they were known as big gluttons who couldn't control themselves, but only in private. They didn't eat in public because it's not refined. Now, if you would look through the peephole, you wouldn't see a refined sight in there. But it was precisely because they were so base that they had to develop something to somehow give them, retain some semblance of humanness, human dignity. And on the contrary, when Tzaddik says, so that we latch on to. Adarabba, we'll learn from them. These are people who are forced to devise something. So let's see what they'll come up with, and we'll use that to enhance our sensitivities, to refine ourselves even more. That's really the answer to your question from before. Are we praising the Goyim? No, we're not praising the Goyim. It's actually representative of their low state. But yet, he also notes the term, Ani oyhev et haparsim. I love the Persians because of this. He says, no. They introduced or highlighted a certain, what he calls, spark of Kedusha. And Rabbi Gamliel and Rabbi Akiva zeroed in on it and hooked onto it. That's the term Oyev. They connected to it. But then they pulled it out for themselves. And now, the Persians can move on to Gehenna. Can you say something?
We have our own values. We have a well-ordered
Apparently, these were certain elements of refinement that we don't necessarily have sources for. It might not have necessarily developed on our own. That's the point. These are things that apparently were not prevalent in Klal Yisrael. And on the contrary, Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Gamliel were saying, let's note that they developed these things. It came from the wrong place, but they did develop these things, and we can utilize it too. Okay. What's that? If there is something that can be defined as good, why not? Why not? Just not everything is good. That's true. Suspect. You definitely do have to be suspect. So leave it to Rabbi Gamliel and Rabbi Akiva to figure out what yes and what not. But on principle, sure. Rav Dessler says this. What? They're polite. They're very polite. Oh, so the truth is, that also, the Ben Yishchai says, you have to differentiate between politeness and derech eretz, which the two are often confused. I'll give a simple example. In English, there's a ridiculous concept called the magic word. Please. Right? That's the magic word. Without that, sentence is worth nothing, and no right to ask for anything. With that, okay, now you can get what you ask for. Now what's the point? Can anybody explain me the value? Anybody can explain it. The value is derech eretz. So can anybody explain to me, the point is to develop derech eretz. There's nothing inherent about the word please. Derech eretz means to ask in a derech eretz stick away. What if a kid comes and says, can I have this in a humble way, in a respectful way? Now, the Western parent, please. Right? Now, if a kid comes and says, please give me that. Oh, okay, that's okay. Derech Eretz means that the kid has to show respect for the person you're asking. Right? Show humility in asking for it. What has that got to do with the word please? So, I'm sorry, people might find this offensive. The point is, you want to train your kids to talk with Derech Eretz, talk respectfully. This is an issue of empty politeness. It really means nothing. Chitzonis. The tone. Okay. So the only smart I can hear is that please, when a kid knows he has to say please, that will in general get him to formulate the question in a more respectful way. But again, is there any need at all? If you train a kid, when he asks for something, you ask, can I have this? Is there any inherent need to add the word please? Or is it just that that's what we grew up with? But there's really nothing to it. So again, if you'll tell me it's a strategy issue, okay, I can hear that. I can hear that it's a strategy thing. It's harder to say things impolitely if you say the word please. Although that can be managed too. Right? That's it? It shows a little refinement. But so again, the point is the refinement. What I'm saying is we have to differentiate between what's just become accepted politeness and inherent derech eretz. The inherent derech eretz that you're looking for is a respectful tone. The respectful approach. But the word turned into the value. That's something in Ochanami. You have to learn to differentiate between that. And that's why we won't necessarily say that German politeness is something necessarily to admire. Not necessarily. But, yes, different goyim, even if they're not good goyim, may have certain attributes that we can gain from. We don't have to be shy of saying that. We do have to be shy. We have to shy away from being too quick to decide to adopt things before they're properly analyzed. What's that? I'm not saying that it's a bad word. What I'm saying is the emphasis that's placed on it is a little bit out of proportion. It turned into such a fundamental concept of derech eretz. Well, okay, might be a little bit of an enhancement. What's the main point? The main point is that you want your children to express respect and humility when they're asking for things. Does it really matter, essentially? how it's expressed. Now, sometimes Moshe Rabbeinu did use it, sometimes he didn't. But again, it's fine to say the word. Okay. Now we move on. Rabbi Gamliel Oimer. Remember a long time ago, we learned the Mishnah, where there was a machlokes about the end of Zman Kriyat Shema, of the evening. Rabbi Gamliel was the most lenient, and he said, until Alois HaShachar. Amar Rav Yehuda, Amar Shmuel. So Rav Yehuda says in the name of Shmuel, Halacha ke Rabbi Gamliel. The halacha follows Rabbi Gamliel, that the time of Kriyat Shema is until Alois HaShachar. Alois HaShachar means when the beginning of the light appears, meaning before the actual, the two famous times is Alois HaShachar and Netzach Hama. Netzach Hama is when the body of the sun actually appears above the horizon. Alois HaShachar is before the body of the sun appears, but the light is already coming up over the horizon. That's Alois HaShachar. Generally speaking, it's 72 minutes before Netzach Hama. Now, the truth is, if we leave it here, we have things very neat, and no need to wonder any further. It seems that that's the latest that you can get, right? Is there any room to allow any further for Zman Kriyat Shema of the evening? Alois HaShachar is the end of the night. Okay. But now we'll see some clauses. Tanya, we have a braisa that says as follows. Amen Shimon ben Yochai Oimer. Pa'amim sha'odom kore Kriyat Shema shtei pa'amim balayla. You can have a situation where a person says Kriyat Shema once after the other, twice at night, one time after the other. Achas koidem shi'al amud ha'shachar. He says one right before amud ha'shachar. V'achas lacha shi'al amud ha'shachar. And one right after amud ha'shachar. V'yoytze bo'en yedei chirvosa. And he's yoytze two kriyashmas with two consecutive recitations. Achas shel yoim v'achas shel laila. One of the daytime, one of the nighttime. One that he says right before Alois HaShachar is Yotze the nighttime one. He says immediately afterwards is Yotze the daytime one. I assume that just because you generally say day before night, I don't know if there's any significance here. What? What's the difference? Zayitzeh, the morning Kriyat Shema. The night time before Alois HaShachar, up to Alois HaShachar, Zayitzeh the night, and then afterwards Zayitzeh the day. Right, so he's just pointing out the novelty of it. That even though it's still night time, he can still be Zayitzeh the morning Kriyat Shema. What? Right, right. Now the Gemara continues. Hagu Fikasha. The truth is, we said something strange here. We said, really, what's the novelty of this statement? To say that you yotze Kriyat Shema, the nighttime Kriyat Shema before Alois HaShachar, that's nothing new about that. The saying is, you can be yotze the morning Kriyat Shema immediately after Alois HaShachar, even though it's still nighttime. That's the novelty. So the Gemara says, Hagu Fikasha. This phrase is self-contradictory. Amarta, you started by saying, meaning we're all familiar with the concept of Bein HaShmashes, the questionable status of the area between Shkia and Seisak HaChavim, right? Now we're sugya, we're going to be focusing on a different Bein HaShmashes, not really Bein HaShmashes, but the same concept, the time between Alois HaShachar and Netzach Hama. What is its status? So what did our Gemara say? Our Gemara said, well, it's night time, but you can be yotze the morning Kriyat Shema. That's basically what our Gemara said. So the Gemara says, Hogu fekasha. This is self-contradictory. Amarta pe'amim sha'adam kere Kriyat Shema shtei pa'amim balayla. He started by saying, a person might recite Kriyat Shema twice at night. Alma, this implies That the period after Amud HaShachar is night time. The other Tani, then you said, Yaitse Ben Yedechai Vasoi. But you can fulfill your obligation, Achashalyim Achashalayla. The latter recitation fulfills the daytime Kriyashma. So first you tell me, well, after Amud HaShachar is still night, but you can be Yaitse the morning Kriyashma. That implies that it's daytime. So, what is its status? The period after Alei Sashacha. If it's nighttime, how can it be Yotze the morning Kriyashma? If it's daytime, why'd you call it nighttime? What? That's right. Right, but he says that you yotze the daytime kriyashma with it. So how can you call it night and say that you yotze the daytime kriyashma? What? Well, he said you might say it twice at night, once before Alei Sashachar, once after Alei Sashachar, and you yotze the daytime kriyashma, implying that from Alei Sashachar you can be yotze the morning kriyashma. But he calls it night. What? That implies that it's not night. But on the other hand, he said, this is the case of a person reciting it twice at night. That's how he put it. You're saying Kriyat Shema twice at night, the second time being after Alei Sashachar, which means that he's saying it's night. And yet you yotze the morning Kriyat Shema. Self-contradictory. So the Gemara says, Loi, lo oilom leliu. It is night. Behadi kari leyoim. Why does he treat it as daytime with regard to Kriyat Shema? Because some people do get up at that time. It is night time. But some people get up then already, and therefore you can be yotze the morning kriyashma. Now this is based, you must remember from the beginning of the Masechta, on the concept that kriyashma, the Torah doesn't say to read kriyashma in the morning and at night. The Torah says to do it when you get up and when you go to sleep. So therefore, even though it basically corresponds to day and night, it doesn't necessarily go by day and night. So therefore we're saying, you're right. Until Netzachama, it's night time. But people start getting up then, you can already read the Shema of Bikumecha, which we call the morning Kriyashma, but it's really a misnomer. It's the getting up time Kriyashma. That's where we stand here. Omam Achibar Chanina, Omer Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi, Halacha k'Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai. The Halacha indeed follows Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai. Okay, so let's just note this carefully, because we're going to go now and see a bit of a different version. So what are we saying? We're saying that although the period after Alei Sashachar is nighttime, you can be yotze the morning Kriyashma then. Nighttime Kriyashma is up till Alei Sashachar. Afterwards, even though it's still night, you can be yotze the morning kriyashma. Okay. What's that? Up until nitz. Alei Sashachar is not nitz. Alei Sashachar is 72 minutes before nitz. It's dawn, yeah. The first rays of light that come up before the sun appears. Okay. Now, ike demasni lehode avacha b'chanina. Now others presented this ruling of Rav Acha bar Chanina that he ruled like Rav Shimon bar Yochai, aha, on a different brisa, which gives a close but different version of what was just stated. Tanya says in another brisa, Rav Shimon bar Yochai oimer mishum Rabbi Akiva. Rav Shimon bar Yochai said in the name of Rabbi Akiva. The first one was his own statement that even though after Alois is nighttime, he can be yotze to the morning kriyashma. Now what does he say from Rabbi Akiva? Listen to this. Sometimes a person might recite Kriyashma twice during the daytime. Achas koidem anetzachama, once before anetzachama, ve'achas la'acha anetzachama. and once after Netzachama. Alright? No, we're not talking about Alois HaShacha now. We're talking about Netzachama. Okay? The Yotze Ben Yedei Chayvasim.
What?
What reason what?
What do you mean? Would he be doing that?
Why would he be doing that? He got home very, very, very late. And
is one ma'ariv?
What's that?
Is one time ma'ariv? Is one?
Yes, yes, yeah. That's what we're saying. Let's see. The Yotze Ben Yedei Chayvasai.
He agrees.
What's that?
He's in agreement.
Let's see, just a second. The Yotze Ben Yedei Chayvasai, and you can fulfill Acha Shel Yom Acha Shel Laila. The evening Kriya Shema and the morning Kriya Shema. Meaning, you daven ma'ariv right before Netz. After Alois HaShachar. Right before Netz. The nighttime Kriya Shema, and immediately afterwards you say the morning Kriya Shema after Netz, and you say the morning Kriya Shema. So what's he saying? What's that?
How do you fit into these two contradictions? There's some like contradictions. The idea of being able to distinguish the two different colors, the blue and the white.
Good question. We'll get to that. That's going to be a fundamental part of this discussion. What?
Isn't it after Alois too late already?
You're right. He's saying a very, very novel thing, which is a big chiddush. She's saying Alois is not too late. We would have thought that Alois is the latest conceivable time. He's saying that Alois is not too late. He's saying after Alois is still okay until Netzachama. That's what he's saying. Big novelty. That's why we're learning this. So now, what did he say? He basically worded exactly the opposite. He's saying, even though the period between Alois and Netz is daytime, you can be yotzei the ma'ariv kriya shma then. So here also the Gemara asks. Not quite. The first Braisa said that you can be yotze the nighttime Kriya Shema up to Alois and the daytime from Alois. The second Braisa is saying you can be yotze the nighttime Kriya Shema until Netz and the morning Kriya Shema from Netz. No, it's not. According to the first opinion, after Alois is too late for the nighttime Kriya Shema. According to the first opinion, nighttime Alois ends the nighttime Kriya Shema. And according to the second opinion, no. Continue with Myron until Netz. It's already starting to get light outside. Don't pay attention. Right? And also, on the morning Kriya Shema, also Machloikis. The first Braisa said, you can begin the morning Kriya Shema at Alois. The second Braisa is saying, you begin the morning Kriya Shema at Netz. So we have a double Machloikis between the two. When does the nighttime Kriya Shema end? Ostensibly. We have a double machlokes between the two. When does the nighttime Kriya Shema end? When does the morning Kriya Shema begin? So let's see. What's that? That's also a good question. We have a lot to discuss. So first the Gemara asks the same question we asked earlier. He's saying, even though it's already daytime, you can be yotze the Ma'ariv Kriya Shema until next. So this is self-contradictory. You said that a person can recite Kriya Shema twice during the day. Meaning, after Alois, it's already daytime. You recite it twice during the day. Once before Netz, once after Netz. That implies that before Netz is already daytime. From Alois, it's daytime. Then you said, Yotze b'hen yedei chayvasai. Even though it's daytime, you can be yotze achas shel yom v'achas shel laila. You can be yotze the morning Kriya Shema after Netz and the nighttime Kriya Shema before Netz, even though that's already daytime. Amar Leilu. He's saying you can be yotze the nighttime Kriya Shema, then that implies that it's night. So the Gemara answers, loy lo olam yamamu. No, according to this braisa, it's daytime. That Bein HaShmash is what we're calling, according to this Braisa, is daytime. So if so, why did he call it nighttime in Kriya Shema sense? How can you be Yotze, the nighttime Kriya Shema, if it's already day? Here also we should be able to guess the answer. Sure, it's daytime, but Kriyat Shema doesn't go by day or night. Some people are still asleep after Alois HaShachar. I'm one of them. Some people are still asleep after Alois HaShachar. And therefore, it's still called B'Shach Becha. It's daytime, but it's still called B'Shach Becha, and you can be Yotze, the nighttime Kriyat Shema then. So now, let's just note what we have here. Well, just that too. Good. We're raising a lot of good points that the Rishonim deal with. The Rashba, the Rush, they all deal with the points you're raising. Well, the Rashba asks that question. Stan is asking, you're saying that, you know what, nighttime ends at Alois HaShachar. But yet you can continue reciting Kriyat Shema until Netz. Why? Because some people sleep until Netz. Imagine that. You can't imagine it, but there are some people who can sleep until Netz. So therefore you can continue with the nighttime Kriyat Shema until Netz. Mishnah tells us that princes sleep until 3 hours into the day. That's why the morning Kriyat Shema extends all that time. So the Rashba asks what you asked. Why doesn't the nighttime Kriyat Shema extend until 3 hours into the day? Because princes are still asleep at that time. So the Rashba answers no. Princes are an extreme minority. When we say that there are still people sleeping until Netz HaChama, it means that there's a significant amount of people sleeping until Netz HaChama. To the extent that we could still define that as sleeping time in a broad sense. But after that already is not. What's that? Well, practically speaking, as far as sleeping goes, many of us are. But here we're talking about the specific phenomenon of Lamaisa, how many people sleep that late. So that, you're right, anybody wants to, in the sense of all the halachas of B'nai Melachim apply to us, yes. But as far as how many people Lamaisa sleep this late, it's too small a percentage to go by.
You dismiss them because they're small numbers. Why do we count them when it comes to the deadline for a morning Kriyat Shema?
So Noach is asking, if they're such a tiny minority, why do we count them for the morning Kriyat Shema? Right? We do base the morning Kriyat Shema on them. So that's the Rashba's next question. After he gives this answer, he asks that question. And he answers that when it comes to the morning Kriyat Shema, to schlep the nighttime Kriyat Shema into the day, even though, yeah, the Torah said B'Shach Becha, but still we know that the Torah generally meant for it to be at night. To schlep it into the day will only do while there's a bigger amount of people still sleeping. And therefore, once it's only a very small minority, we won't take it further. But the morning Kriyat Shema, the Kumecha Kriyat Shema, which really was meant to be in the day, will go by any amount of people who are still sleeping. So, Lamaisa, we'll end off just presenting where we stand here, and we'll continue this next time. This is an important discussion. Lamaisa, where we stand now, there are two Brises saying what sounds like the same thing, but are basically opposite things. The first Brises said, even though, again, we're talking about the period between Alois and Netz, okay? Even though the period between Alois and Netz is nighttime, you can be Yotze the morning Kriyat Shema already then. The second Brisa said, even though it's daytime, you can be Yotze the nighttime Kriyat Shema then. So we have 3 points of debate. Let's just note this. We'll end with that. The first Brisa considers it nighttime. Yet you can be Yotze the morning. Second Brisa considers it daytime. The first Brisa says that the nighttime Kriyat Shema ends at Alois. Second Brisa says it ends at Netz. That's point number two. Point number three is, when does the morning Kriyat Shema begin? First Brisa said the morning Kriyat Shema begins at Alois. Second Brisa said the morning Kriyat Shema begins at Netz. We're going to have to put that all together next time there's a session. Okay. Thank you.